Is the United States in a war with Iran? You might think that's an odd question. We've been talking about it since this began. President Trump, in his initial announcement, said that, you know, sometimes troops die in war and that's going to happen, et cetera. Well, now that it looks like he's trying to walk that back a little bit and talking about how it's not really war, but don't worry because it's going to be wrapped up really soon. We're going to try to figure out what is the truth with all these shifting messages and what does that actually mean for on the ground realities. And we couldn't have anybody better back with us today for the first time in a while. Always a delight for me to have Alexander Mercurius, co-host of the Durand and also of the his own show there in at A Mercurius on X. Alexander, welcome back to the show. Always happy to have you here.
And always delighted to be here, Daniel.
Well, look, let's just get brought into it because, and actually, Gary was telling me just before we came on here that President Trump, I guess, is still speaking, right? Is that right, Gary?
Yeah, indeed. There's a cabinet meeting right now. Everybody's in place.
Okay. And Gary, because you know, I was distracted with something else a minute ago. What's the gist of what he said with the Iran war stuff?
What were you saying just now? Most importantly, listen, he said before this even started, we're looking at 4 to 6 weeks. He goes, not only are we on schedule, we are way ahead of schedule.
Okay. All right. Well, that, if anything else happens, Gary, you feel free to break in if he says anything during this show. But, you know, that's a little odd, Alexander, I got to say, in a sea of oddities, if we can go there. Because, look, this is day 27. So this tomorrow is the 4 week mark. And if we're ahead of schedule, 4 to 6 weeks, then shouldn't it be over by now?
Well, pretty much. I mean, I don't, of course, credit that it is in fact that we are ahead of schedule. I would have said that we are clearly not ahead of any kind of schedule.
Exactly.
That's what I was going to say. I think maybe at the start of this, the president hoped, believed, was told that it would all be over very quickly. But I doubt that he thought that we would be where we are. And of course, he's being optimistic. He has to be optimistic. There's a political imperative that requires him to be optimistic. There's an economic imperative that requires him to be optimistic. And that's the message that he's conveying. The one thing I would say is if he is talking about being ahead on a 6 week schedule, then maybe it reinforces my own feeling that he's trying to find a way out of this, that things are getting very complicated, very difficult, and that he's trying to find a way out. But that's just my sense, and maybe one shouldn't place too much weight on it.
Well, you talk about the political imperative, and let's just take a look at that, what I call kind of a ticking time bomb of sorts, and that is the price of oil. And you see that it's continuing to tick up here, and you know that's where the war started. Or, well, I'm sorry, that's not where the war started. That's where President Trump's comment earlier this week that there would be a pause in this ultimatum that he gave to the Iranian side. That's actually not working out so good so far, because now then you see after initially dropping, now it's starting to go back up as people are going, yeah, but is there really going to be an end to this? Because, you know, concurrent with this, and as of yesterday, lots of talk about maybe doubling down and expanding, going in potentially on the ground. And so how do you see that that dovetailing with talking about a schedule if there's actually going to be some sort of a ground operation?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that, yes, clearly there's been a concerted, I mean, to me, it looks like there's been a concerted effort to keep the energy markets calm, to prevent oil rising above $100 a barrel. But of course, the risk in doing that, if you are successful for any short space of time, is that if you are dealing with a supply shock, if the underlying problem is that there's less and less oil on the market, then keeping the price lower than it would be if the market was adjusting by itself risks a sudden surge in prices when the oil shortage becomes more difficult to mask. So it can actually cause problems going down the line. Now, I think the president is in a difficult position, obviously. On the one hand, he's got the war going on. The Iranians are proving very resistant to negotiations on the kind of terms that he wants. He's set out various proposals, various ideas for what terms that he wants. But ultimately, when you drill it down, it seems to me that he's still talking about zero enrichment by Iran and Iran placing enormous restrictions on its ballistic missile arsenal. Now, the Iranians are not going to agree to that at the present time, and they are saying that they are not going to agree to that. They're not even prepared to negotiate about it. So, since the president needs to end the war quickly because of this problem with the escalating energy costs, he has to put the Iranians in a position where they're going to be more accommodating to his demands. He's got to make them feel that they are losing when at the present time they think they are winning. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately because I think this is entirely the wrong way to approach this, but unfortunately that, it seems to me, is pushing him towards further escalation, towards ground operations, military deployments, escalation of strikes against Iran. And I suspect that at some point over the next couple of days, that is what we're likely to see. He needs to end it fast. He's having trouble getting the Iranians to accept that they have lost. They don't feel that they have lost. They don't even feel that they're losing. So that pushes him to escalate further in order to convince them that they have lost.
And let's take a look at some of the reasons why Iran might think that way, because everything President Trump has been saying is that the war is already basically over. We have won. He said that on so many different occasions. It's basically done. We've destroyed all of their stuff, and he rattled off this list of things that have been destroyed. But then you look at some of the other factors, and here's one in particular. This is in the New York Times. I think it was yesterday. Or it might have even been today, actually, said that Iran's attacks forces U.S. troops to work remotely. And when you get into the details of this, it says Iran has bombed U.S. bases across the Middle East in retaliation for the U.S.-Israeli war. Turns out there are 17 of them total, forcing many American troops to relocate to hotels and office spaces throughout the region. Many of the 13 military bases in the region used by the American troops are all but uninhabitable. The lack of a better planning, the lack of better planning, some military officials said, also reflects a miscalculation on the part of the administration about how Iran would respond. So we actually just had Joe Kent, who resigned as the number two at the director under the director of national intelligence in the U.S., and he confirmed that he said he thinks that there was a significant underestimation of the Iranian side. He thinks a lot of people viewed them as like, oh, well, they're like the Iraqi insurgency or the Taliban in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a nuisance, but it's something you can handle. And he said there was a misapprehension of how effective the modern capabilities of Iran were. How do you see it?
I think that's exactly right. I think that there was a critical failure to understand that Iran, for all its many problems, its the disorganization of its financial markets, its very complicated political system, which I think most outsiders, including myself, find very difficult to understand, but that Iran does have significant strengths. It has a large industrial base. It has a significant technology sector. It has many engineers. It has a military tradition, which, soldiers, I think, know how important tradition is to militaries, but Iran has it. And it has organizations and resources and capabilities, and above all, it has will. So I think that none of this was properly understood. I think what has happened is that the United States has fought against much weaker opponents in the Middle East. Opponents, incidentally, who are not to be completely written off. I mean, one can talk about, other Arab armies, but they certainly have been able to cause, to put up resistance and to do damage. But no Arab state that the United States has contend with has had to contend with up to now has had the range of missile, drone, surveillance capabilities, staff, you know, planning staff, command and control that Iran has. And I don't think that this is something that the United States anticipated.
Well, they definitely didn't, and they should have. For a number of reasons. Number one, the intelligence community was given accurate assessments of the capabilities of the Iranian side prior to this. But even just looking at history, I mean, you just mentioned, and he told us the dismissal. Well, they're like the Taliban. Now, the Taliban on a tactical level, we won every engagement. I had two combat deployments there, and I can attest that they never won a single engagement. Some of which I was, I didn't participate in terms of firing, but I was attacked on a base when they attacked, and I just watched how they were completely destroyed by U.S. air power, et cetera. We won every tactical engagement. We lost the war because it's not a matter of who can win the battle. It's a matter of who has the strongest political will and can outlast the other. And after two decades, that was us. And let's even look at the 2003 through basically 2011 Iraq war, which we claim to have won. But I can tell you from firsthand knowledge that the so-called surge that Petraeus is credited for having won that war was not accurate, at least not completely. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, and I talked to the U.S. our 1st Armored Brigade commander that was at the center of all of these, the rise of the Sons of Iraq and that whole thing where we ended up turning the Sunni portion of the insurgency onto our side, et cetera. That was not because we had a great idea. That was exclusively because they chose of their own to say, hey, they would rather ally with the U.S. against the Shia folks in there and the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was also against them. They said, hey, we can coordinate with the U.S. against our other enemies in the region and can outlast us. If it's not for that, and this is what the brigade commander told me, he said we would still have been, this was in 2010, I think, when I interviewed him, he said we'd still be fighting today if they hadn't of their own accord changed, meaning that even the insurgents would have been able to thwart us had it not been for their decision to do something different, not because of what we did. And then you saw that fell apart just 3 years after we left, and we had to come back to where we have just recently left again. So the bottom line is all of our experience, and I could throw Vietnam into this mix, is disaster for our side, underestimating. And now it looks like we've done it again. And I want to, I guess, just kind of reinforce this point by something President Trump said last night, to where he still seems to be underestimating the complexity and the difficulty by saying this really isn't even a war.
Number one is they want to deflect from all of the tremendous success that we're having in this military operation. I won't use the word war because they say if you use the word war, that's maybe not a good thing to do. They don't like the word war because you're supposed to get approval. So I'll use the word military operation, which is really what it is. It's called a military decimation. But they don't like the good publicity. They don't like to see us succeed. They want to see our country fail.
So, I mean, there's the little thing of it violates the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. War Powers Act, the U.S. law, by having a war without congressional approval. But we'll set that aside. But he's like, it's so funny, too. Is that, you know, we used to, in the first part of the Russia-Ukraine war, we used to mock Putin and the Russians for calling it a special military operation. We said, of course, it's a war, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then now here, literally, our president is doing the same thing. How do you view that?
Well, absolutely. But coming back to your first point, this continued underestimation, this refusal to recognize that the other side is an adversary, and an adversary with resources and will, is ultimately the problem. Whatever miscalculations the Russians made at the start of the special military operation, and they made many, they understood that fact very fast. And by late 2022, they were reorganizing, and they were saying that we're in for the long war. And they understood that it would be a long war. They prepared for the offensive that was launched against them in 2023. And they have been fighting on the offensive since then. And it's been slow. It's been a grinding battle of attrition. But they've worked attrition to their advantage. What the president is doing is he also refuses to call it a war, just as the Russians at the start of the special military operation refused to call it a war. But he is not grasping that which the Russians did grasp fairly quickly, that this isn't something, this isn't a walk in the park, this isn't a simple military excursion, that it is actually a war. And the result is that attrition is working against him. It's working against the United States, whereas, and it is working in this conflict in favor of the Iranians. At the very least, there needs to be a major recalibration, a review of where we are, and a discussion about whether, given the military realities at this present time, it is viable to continue this war at all, and if not, to see how a negotiation can be conducted to end it, which avoids many of the many really enormous political damage that might be done.
The end of it, in that same conversation where President Trump was speaking on there, he also talked about how basically this is something that he's got under control and it's not a problem. This is in the context, and let me just set this up, from we had an alleged 48-hour deadline that he was going to hit Iranian energy and basically knock them off the grid, knock their power out, which Iran said, if you do that, then we're going to start knocking the power out of all of your allies in the region, to include yourself and in Israel. And then he says, okay, you know what? We'll give you 5 days. We'll push that back a little bit. So that 5 days expires tomorrow. Tomorrow night, our time. So there's a near-term potential problem coming up in here, or else he's going to have to back off of that again. And at the same time, we're trying to work with the negotiated settlement, as President Trump said from the tarmac a couple of days ago, that we're talking to somebody on the inside, et cetera. So we're trying to figure out where we're going. And yet he still says in this clip here that basically don't worry about it, because this is all but one.
So as we rebuild, it's going to come back very quickly. It's already back. I mean, it's back. It went down a little bit. I actually thought, when I went on this excursion, as I call it, excursion into hell, excursion into a terrible place, when I went on to do something that for 47 years should have been done by any of the other presidents, and you heard numerous of them said they wished they did it, but they didn't have the guts to do it. We had no choice, but I thought it would be much worse. I thought that the energy prices, oil price would go up higher. I thought the stock market would go somewhat lower, but it didn't matter to me. It's short term. What we had to do is get rid of the cancer. We had to cut out the cancer. The cancer was Iran with a nuclear weapon, and we've cut it out. Now we're going to finish it off.
Now we're going to finish it off. Well, I mean, how are you going to, with that? That was last night now. How are you going to come to some sort of a negotiated end to get this off the table if you're saying that they're a cancer that has to be cut out and we're going to finish the deal? Or you're concurrently talking about, and we'll get on this in more detail in a minute, potentially something escalating on the ground. Mm. Where are we on this confusing thing?
Well, this is the problem, because, again, the president isn't really providing there an achievable objective, at least not one that the Iranians could work with in negotiations. If he's talking about a cancer, then it's difficult to see how that can mean anything less than the potential change of government in Iran. Now, the Iranians are never going to negotiate themselves away, not in that way, about nuclear negotiations. Yes, they were prepared to negotiate about that. They did negotiate about it. They made substantial concessions in recent negotiations back in 2015. They actually came to an agreement about it too. I know many people are critics of that agreement. In some ways I am. But it could have been built on. It could have been developed. There might have been all kinds of proposals made going forward for sanctions relief, for integrating Iran into the global economy in return for further monitoring and the ending of the sunset clauses and all of those things that rightly worried people about that agreement. But he speaks about this as being essentially a done thing, about cutting out the cancer, about accepting all of these prices, or the price, you know, higher oil prices, lower stock markets, and those kind of things. But what he is not doing is providing a clear pathway forward. He is not explaining, firstly, clearly, what his objective in the end is. I mean, cancer, nuclear Iran, that kind of, these are not, as I said, things that the Iranians can work with. He's not setting up a clear objective. And he's not explaining how we're going to reach that objective. And say that it's all been done and that we have won isn't obviously a pathway forward to reaching that point.
And one of the things he has said is that, and this is a couple of days ago, which he's said many times since, is that there are negotiations going on at the top level, that he's speaking with somebody serious, that I think he said it was just yesterday that the Iranians have given him a really big prize and a really big present that he thought was wonderful and shows I'm talking to the right people. That's what he said yesterday. But here is the senior diplomat for Iran, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, kind of scratching his head.
At present, we have no intention of negotiating, and no negotiations have taken place. The fact that they are now talking about negotiations is, in itself, an admission of defeat. Were they not demanding unconditional surrender? So why are they now speaking about negotiations? I will explain this further, because there are no negotiations taking place. But the very fact that an enemy that was seeking our unconditional surrender is now talking about negotiations, requesting talks and mobilizing its highest officials to negotiate with the Islamic Republic, means accepting defeat. We want the war to end, but on our terms, in a way that ensures it will not be repeated.
So you seem to have two immovable objects and two contradictory sets of objectives. How is this going to get resolved?
Well, I think there have to be negotiations if it's going to be resolved. And sooner or later, in some way or other, negotiations are going to take place. I mean, the United States cannot just pack its bags and leave the Middle East. I mean, that would be impossible. And no one should expect that. If anybody in Iran thinks it's going to happen, it's not going to happen. It would be bad for the Iranians if it did. So, and the Iranians are not going to simply agree to go away. Again, by now, people should understand that that isn't going to happen. At some point, in some form, talks do need to start. And I think that the correct way to do that is not to pretend the talks are taking place when they're clearly not taking place. Not to pretend that there's a negotiation process already underway when there isn't. It is to talk to the various countries that have influence to see whether they can persuade the Iranians to agree to a negotiation and to find through that negotiation eventually some route forward. The Iranians are going to take a stronger, more hardline position in those negotiations than they were doing just a few weeks ago in Geneva. But we are where we are if we can start some kind of negotiation process, then eventually both sides have a common interest in coming to some kind of understanding with each other. The Iranians won't want their country incessantly bombed. They will not want this situation of crisis to continue indefinitely. And the United States needs to have stability in the Middle East, a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, a resupply of oil. Once these interests are understood, then a way forward can probably be found.
But then again, that's the real rub, isn't it, about that Strait of Hormuz, especially because you can make the argument that one of Iran's biggest conventional capabilities that I think was significantly underestimated, I think, in both Israel and the United States, and that is their missile and drone forces, which have shown to be quite resilient to all the firepower we brought to bear on there. But I think it's pretty clear that the absolute number one chokehold that Iran has in their number one leverage is that Strait of Hormuz. And so we're now on day 27 of this war, and the Strait is still firmly in control of Iran, and nothing we've been able to do, not these 10,000 bomb strikes that we've allegedly had, has budged them from that. So the question is, how do we either negotiate that away, or is there a military path to open it? Now, if you listen to General Jack Keane, you might think that the military path held some options.
These people that say, oh my, the Iranians kind of surprised us with the Straits of Hormuz. Give me a break. This has been a part of our repertoire for years. Listen, Admiral Cooper, who you had there discussing what's going down, the reality is on the Straits of Hormuz, we are going to take that by force and keep it open for as long as we have to be there to keep it open. And that is why we appealed for assistance, because we have warships who are doing offensive operations. We have warships who are doing defensive operations. And obviously we can spare some to do some escorting through the Straits. But we needed help for others to come. And obviously now they are coming, and they're coming by the scores. Now we're up to 30 countries that want to help.
Okay, yeah, that's a big asterisk on that 30 countries that want to help, because nobody wants to put military power in there. Nobody wants to send their ships to the bottom of the Persian Gulf or in the middle of that strait. So far, nobody signed up, and no American ship has dared to cross that strait either. So when he's talking there pretty cocky about, give me a break, of course we foresaw all this, then why, after now just about 4 weeks, are the straits still closed? And do you see any prospect that any of these 30 countries, especially the Europeans, are going to sign up to send warships to escort ships through the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, I think you anticipated my point. If it was so easy to do, why has it not been done? If it was anticipated in advance, why was it not done immediately? Clearly, it was not anticipated, which is, by the way, remarkable. And clearly, it is not that easy to do, because had it been that easy, we would have done it by now. We would not have a situation where for weeks we've been tolerating oil prices hovering around $100 a barrel and going up beyond that, and oil shortages and that sort of thing. And as with these 30 countries, I don't know which countries he's referring to, because if we're talking about Europe, and realistically, if we're talking about military forces, the only countries in the world that are in a position to provide military forces here that might have any value in trying to unblock the Strait of Hormuz are the Europeans, and the Europeans absolutely do not want to be involved. Japan, which I understand has a powerful navy and which is in considerable difficulties, it doesn't want to be involved. China was asked to be involved, which I have to say I found absolutely extraordinary. Anyway, they basically said no. So I don't understand why General Keane is saying those things, because this isn't happening. Now, the Iranians are not going to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz. What they might do, what they conceivably might do in a negotiation, is that they might agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz if they have cast iron guarantees that there will be no resumption of an attack upon themselves. I could see a conceivable situation where the Iranians might do that, because they would want to resume their own oil exports and they would want to do those things. But short of that, obviously, they are not going to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, because it is, as you absolutely rightly said, their big strategic, gives them what gives them their big strategic advantage. And clearly, it's not as straightforward an operation to reopen them as General Keane is saying.
Yeah, and I think that I mean, if that is conceivable, it is theoretically possible. It is something that you can see. Yeah, if we can get the people to agree into this, meaning the United States and in Iran particularly, there is a path to where you could come to that negotiation. But then there's that sticky thing in there about the Israelis, who would have historically, so far in this war, anytime there's been any look that President Trump is thinking about some kind of negotiations, they throw some kind of monkey wrench into, because that's the last thing they want, is to have a situation to where the Iranian regime that existed prior to the war under Ayatollah Khamenei, now led by Mujtaba Khamenei as the supreme leader, to leave that in power, to leave it in a stronger position with less sanctions on it, and still have effective control over that Strait of Hormuz, and now some sort of guarantees. We'll see, you know, who knows how that would be working out. But if that ended the war, that's something that Israel wouldn't like, because that would literally leave Iran in a stronger position than it was prior to the war, which is entirely predictable. But this irrational thinking is where we are in this point right here. Now, let me ask you one specific question. That you were mentioning here a second ago about the Europeans. And I wonder if you could briefly explain to us a little bit, what is the British? Because if there's anybody historically the best naval power in Europe, and that's going to be the UK, where are they with this? Because this started with before the war started with Keir Starmer saying you cannot use RAF Fairford or British bases to have a war against Iran, because we don't think that's a good idea. It's not even legal, et cetera. And then that shifted a little bit. But where is it now? So I wonder if you could just kind of walk us through where the UK was prior to the war, where they have shifted, and where are they now, especially on this issue of sending British warships or military folks to either take part in a ground offensive or to open the strait?
I think the British government has found itself in a very, very difficult position. I mean, they should have been very forthright before the conflict began. They should have come up to Washington. They should have said, look, this is, we're hearing these reports that this is what's being planned. We don't think this is a good idea at all. We are extremely vulnerable to disruption in oil markets. We are particularly vulnerable in that regard. If this is indeed being planned, we want to know what that plan is. And we want to know what you're going to do if the Strait of Hormuz is closed. And unfortunately, there is no evidence that the British ever did anything like that. And instead, we got these very difficult conversations between the president and the prime minister, in which the president pressed the prime minister for the British to become involved. And of course, the British don't want to seem to say no, because we are so deeply dependent for so many things on the United States nowadays, and it is always a very uncomfortable position for any British government to say no to the President of the United States. But the realities are that there is very little practically we can do. Now, once upon a time, the Royal Navy spanned the world. It was the most powerful navy in the world. Those days are long gone. We do have some formidable ships. We have extremely well-trained crews. We have some nuclear submarines, none of which is particularly useful for a conflict in the Strait of Hormuz. The Royal Navy is not designed for this conflict. We don't have minesweepers, apparently, that would be useful in clearing mines if any mines were deployed in the Strait of Hormuz. And that is a serious worry. And if we're talking about air defense capabilities and carriers, well, we cannot add much realistically to what the Americans already have. Our fleet is relatively small. And beyond that, any such naval deployment by the Royal Navy to the Persian Gulf to involve itself in this conflict would be bitterly and fiercely opposed by many, many people in Britain. So a government that did that would trigger a political crisis over and above and on top of all of the other crises that we already have here. So I don't think it's going to happen. And I think that the same calculation is being made by governments all across Europe. Germany has said this is not our war. President Macron, France actually has a bigger navy at the present time than Britain does. But the French have come and they've sort of given some indications that they might be involved. But then President Macron says that we're only prepared to do it when the fighting ends, which basically defeats the point. So nobody in Europe is going to do very much. They don't want to say no. But that's ultimately
that's what they're saying.
They're in. That's what
which then makes the claim that 30 nations have signed up to help, none of which he cited, by the way, General Keane in that last soundbite. So that's kind of a tell of its own. Well, if we can't force an open to the Strait of Hormuz with naval power, then maybe some are suggesting maybe we can do it on the ground. So apparently there was number one, as we've been talking about here before, and I'm sure you've been talking about it on your show, the Duran and your own YouTube channel, is that there has been the brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division, two Marine Expeditionary Units, the 31st and the 11th, have one has basically arrived. Another one is still maybe a couple of weeks away. And a bunch of Delta Force / Special Operations Forces ground troops. We've had A-10 ground support fighter jets, and then also Apache gunships that are also for ground. So a lot of ground power is moving in there. Well, yesterday on Capitol Hill here, there was administration officials that briefed select members of Congress about what their next plan might be. And it left a lot of them pretty unhappy, even including some in the president's own party, like Nancy Mace.
Was it the information that you were receiving or the lack of information that you were receiving?
Was it a
distinction?
I would say that it's both. And I would say that you saw Republicans across the spectrum today express their frustration. You saw Republicans and Democrats alike. I was not convinced when I walked out of there that troops on the ground were necessary to declare victory. But I have a hard time understanding what Karg Island has to do with some of our objectives.
And I'm just getting some news here that the Axios is reporting that the Pentagon prepares for a massive final blow of Iran war. While President Trump is talking about maybe peace with his mouth, apparently with his fist, he's preparing for something else. And you saw Nancy Mace's response there. You can pretty well read between the lines what was told there. What do you think may be coming on the ground? And what is this make any sense at all?
Well, to me, again, this is not an area that, I mean, I haven't got a background in this area, but I cannot see what sense it makes. I don't understand what capturing Karg Island, which I accept the US military can do, but I don't understand how that changes the overall situation. There's been talk about various islands in the Strait of Hormuz, which are also claimed by the UAE, by the way. I accept, again, the US military can capture those islands. But how does that ultimately change the overall picture? The Iranians could still plant mines in the sea. They could still create disruption that way. They could still use drones. They could still use missiles. I've had experience with shipping. I cannot imagine the shippers or insurance companies will be happy sending their ships into what would remain, in fact, become an even more intensified war zone. And, well, you're showing pictures there of Karg Island. It's far from the Strait of Hormuz. It's quite close to the Iranian coastline. I'm told that it is within range of Iranian land-based artillery. It would be it'd be very risky for US troops that were deployed there, unless, of course, the shoreline were captured, which would mean sending troops into the Iranian mainland, which is a whole new set of problems. And I read a rather troubling article, I think it was in the Financial Times, which said that one of the real risks of this is that if you do capture Karg Island or you do capture some of these other islands, the entire strategy of the US military is going to be focused on protecting the troops trying to hold on to these islands, which will mean that there will be less energy, less a diversion, if you like, of military power from offensive tasks in Iran itself. It will become more a defensive struggle to try to protect these islands. I repeat again, this is not my background. I don't know whether that is a valid criticism, but to me, at least, it made a kind of sense. So I just don't see how this solves any of the underlying problems. You don't want a couple of islands which you might have to protect and which you would need to protect at enormous cost. You need peace with Iran. That is the objective that people should be focusing on at this time.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, aside from that, not, and I can absolutely confirm that that small number of troops, all those troops are, just for people's awareness, with the so-called elite 82nd Airborne Division and the Marines, they are somebody that can handle a pinpoint target. They can seize an airfield if they have enough of them. They can make an insertion quick, and they can get somewhere very fast. But the only as an opening round to something. You can't sustain. They're not troops that are designed to sustain anything. They can only get somewhere quick. They can do something that takes people by surprise. They can seize different assets and so, but then they have to be reinforced really quickly, or because of their lightness, they can be counterattacked and destroyed. So I don't even understand what the hope is, because so far anyway, I haven't seen any other heavier forces also deploying that they would be the opening gambit for. Where is the staying power? I haven't even seen that apply or arrive in the region yet. So I can confirm that your understanding is correct, that they will not be able to accomplish anything militarily. And then you have the bigger issue of that would, even if you somehow magically did get a success there and held an island and caused some financial problems, that does nothing to the control of the government, does nothing about the missile program. It does nothing about the alleged kilograms of reprocessed nuclear material. So you get none of those things solved. No. And you don't get the strait open. Other than that, it seems like a grand idea.
Well, indeed. I mean, I would just add something else, which is that, of course, Iran had a long war with Iraq in the 1980s. It lost territory during that war. I mean, it lost territory in important places. That didn't cause Iran to capitulate. On the contrary, what it did was it motivated them to fight even more in order to gain their country back. So, I mean, seizing Kharg Island, I don't see that it solves any problem. I could see, on the contrary, how it could make things a lot worse.
A lot worse. It would. That's just kind of the situation in the Gulf. I want to turn in the remainder of the time we have to seeing what things look like from the Russian side, because Russia and China and Iran are all part of BRICS. Number one, Russia gets, has a relationship with Iran that helps them in their own war with drone components and possibly some other things as well. And that's been kind of a two-way street, and certainly China has issues of interest with the Iranian oil, which they want to see continue to come to them without interruption, et cetera. The reports have been that China has been providing some intelligence and also targeting and satellite imagery, and the Russians apparently, reports just out in the last 24 hours, apparently they're helping with other kinds of technology in addition to any kind of intelligence support. Well, President Putin actually addressed this for one of the first times I saw it yesterday, and he had some interesting comments.
There are some estimates that you can compare this situation with the coronavirus pandemic that impeded the development of all the regions of all the continents. That's why they compare it with this pandemic, because the events that the global community is faced with recently shows that these heavy blows to the investment, to the international relations, to the foreign affairs, these heavy blows are happening more and more often. They are becoming a new reality, and they become a backdrop for the global economy of its transition to a new state. And to be up to this challenge, what do we need to do? We need to be strong. And we keep on saying this over and over again. And we need to be united in understanding what national interests are.
So what is the subtext there? I mean, when he says we need to be strong and we need to be united, what is he? What does that mean for Russia in relation to this this conflict in the Middle East?
Well, I think there's two things to say, and they are both there in that speech that Putin just gave, the comments that Putin just gave. Now, the Russians, Russia is a country that is very, very focused on security. And security means that the preferred situation for the Russians in any global situation is one of stability. I know there's a narrative out there that the Russians like this war because it's pushed up oil prices, and that's going to make them an awful lot of money. And of course it is, and they will take advantage of that. But that does not mean that they want the war to continue indefinitely. For them, that is dangerous. It is unpredictable. It could create all kinds of problems in the future. If Iran comes out successful, then that might make Iran very powerful, or at least in its own perception, very powerful. The Russians have always found the Iranians very difficult people to work with, by the way. So that might make them even more difficult to work with in the future. They do not want the Iranians to be in that position. They do not want the Iranians getting into trouble. They do not want Iran collapsing, because they do not want to collapse in Iran close to the southern regions of their own country. And in terms of oil and the situation with oil, yes, of course, in the short term, the oil price rises. But if it goes up to, say, $200 a barrel and precipitates a global recession, that itself creates instability. And it could also lead to an oil price crash, which comes with a whole further set of problems. So what the preferred Russian policy would be some kind of negotiated outcome that restores stability. In the meantime, what the Russians have to do, or at least this is what they're saying to themselves, is they say the world is becoming more unstable all the time. We already have our problems with the Europeans and the Americans and the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We see this crisis in the Middle East. We have to strengthen our own positions domestically. We can't afford to show any sign of indiscipline or weakness even. And we have to be focused particularly on ensuring stability at home. It is even more important now, given that there is no stability abroad.
And that's an interesting set of, I guess, complicated in chances, because on the one hand, Russia would certainly seem to benefit from higher oil prices, because now then they're getting a lot more money for their resource. They've had sanctions partially reduced on them by the United States so that they can produce more oil and ship it out. So that's certainly helpful. But the global instability, I guess it's there's like a narrow band in there to where they're like, okay, I'm all right with this part here. But outside of that, there's exactly other problems to cause. That's an interesting, I had not considered those additional things from the Russian side. Well, that's not all that we heard from Russia today. Also, Putin's special envoy Dmitriev had this to say about the conflict.
Видим, что наступает самый мощный энергетический кризис за всю историю человечества. К нему абсолютно не подготовлена ни Европа, ни Британия. Мало того, они сами выстрелили себе в ногу, отказавшись от российских энергоносителей. И поэтому наш прогноз очень простой, что фактически наступит сейчас мощнейшая деиндустриализация в Европе, мощнейшие проблемы Британии. И все это связано просто с ошибочными решениями британских, европейских политиков по энергетике. И очень важно, чтобы мы эту тему поднимали, потому что когда там не будет, соответственно, бензина на заправках, когда не будет работы, люди в Европе, в Британии должны понимать, что это вот в результате этих ошибочных решений, абсолютно четких, понятных, Урсулы фон дер Лайен и других русофобских, европейских и британских политиков.
So, I mean, does he have a point there? I mean, and let's look at it from two aspects, first of all, because there is already an ongoing issue between many in the European Union and the cutoff of Russian oil and gas, which the European Union wanted to do nice and easy and schedule it out then to 2027. But Russia's saying, you know what, maybe we'll just turn that tap off right away. So that's already been an issue. That's a problem for Hungary because they don't want it, and they're actually aggravated it Ukraine itself for potentially blocking the path for them to get it. So that's an issue. But now that on top of that, you want to weave on there these really high prices for both oil and gas. How is that going to affect the economies in Europe on top of these other problems?
Right. It's going to create massive problems for the European economies. I mean, we are already, as Dimitri has said, in a process of deindustrialization. The most vulnerable country, as he correctly identified amongst the big countries in Europe, is actually Britain, where we have very, very low fuel reserves indeed. So we could, and we already have very, very high energy prices, twice as high as France. So we are particularly vulnerable, but everybody is vulnerable. Now, listening to Dmitriev, we need to understand that Dmitriev is somebody that we might be seeing quite a lot of over the next few months, especially if the problems in the global economy grow. Because based on following on from what Putin was saying, I highlighted Russian concerns for stability. And this is why Putin talks about Russia needing to be, especially at this time, needing to be strong. But there is the other side, which is that for the Russians, this is an opportunity. They produce oil. They produce gas. They produce fertilizer. They produce tungsten. They produce naphtha. They produce fertilizer. They produce all of these things that are now going to be in critically short supply. Who is the front man in discussing all of these things? Obviously, the person who is the head of Russia's direct investment fund, the person who is involved in agreeing financial, trade and economic contacts with the rest of the world, who is, of course, Kirill Dmitriev. So when Dmitriev speaks in this way and talks about all of these enormous problems that the Europeans are going to be facing, he does so knowing that the Russians are going to be in a very strong position of advantage in a few months. And he's been positioned to say, look, you are where you are. Your factories are closing. You're facing power blackouts. You have no option but to come to us because we are, in practical terms, the only people who can help you in this situation. So if you do come to us, obviously, we want something in return. We want all these sanctions that you've been imposing on us. We want those taken away. We will probably want other concessions as well, because, of course, after all that's happened over the last 5 years, there is a deficit, a massive deficit of trust between us and you. So what Dmitriev is doing is he is laying the groundwork, and he's doing this perfectly well aware of what he's doing, by the way. And he's clearly, this is clearly flows from discussions that are taking place in Moscow. He's laying the groundwork for further negotiations, which are to come, at which he will be center stage. And they won't just be negotiations with the Americans, they will be negotiations with the Europeans too. At least that is what the Russians at this time think.
And really, I guess you can say, fortunately/unfortunately, this tremendous opportunity is just fallen into the Russians' lap because of this very foolish war of choice that we have started in the Middle East. Not only do we give leverage to Iran that they never had before, especially with control over the strait, we've also handed a lot of advantages and now new assets and capabilities to the Russian side. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's exactly right. And the Russians know about that. And they're going to use it. I mean, they're going to exploit it. And they know how. They've done this in the past. They know how to take advantage of these sort of situations. But that doesn't mean that in the long term, they want to be indefinite spoilers, that they want an endless prolongation of the war. Because that then brings us back to the other concerns that the Russians also have about
instability
and stability, which are always there in the background.
And so let me ask you here in the last few minutes we have, How is Ukraine viewing all this? How is Zelensky? Because if this is an unexpected windfall in the lap of Putin and a help to the Iranian side, it is definitely a bad thing for the Ukrainian side. How are they viewing things, especially as we're just about out of the muddy season and it could open up into a spring potential offensive on the Russian side?
Well, he's very, very depressed and very, very worried about it. And if you track his statements recently, you can see this. He went on a tour of Europe trying to drum up more support from the Europeans. He's at the moment still holding out for this 90 billion euro loan, which he absolutely needs because financial pressures in Ukraine are increasing. And for the moment, that's not coming through. And he's the weapons flow from the West is dwindling. The Germans are saying that they can't buy air defense missiles from the United States at the moment because they're all needed in the Middle East. So that's leaving Zelensky and Ukraine more exposed in the sky. And as you absolutely rightly say, in 2, 3, 4 weeks' time, we will be into the spring period. The ground will harden. The movement of forces will resume, and Ukraine has never looked more vulnerable. So he's very worried about this, but not so worried that for the moment he shows any willingness to make concessions in the negotiations. And he's complaining again about how the Americans are putting pressure on him to get Ukrainian troops out of Donbass. And again, that's something that he's not prepared to do. And I don't think he ever will do. Because, again, he understands that his own political position in Kiev would not survive if he did it. And that is his immediate priority.
That is really just unfortunate to hear from the perspective of the Ukrainian people, especially the men who are doing the fighting, because it's a futile operation that they continue to resist, continue to die, even if it's smaller numbers here in the last couple of months. But that's likely to increase when the weather gets better. And towards the same event, which is either a military defeat or a negotiated capitulation. I don't see anything else in the cards, do you?
No, I don't. But I think the Ukrainians also need to say to themselves that they're very, very lucky in one important respect, that they are not dealing with an unreasonable adversary. I mean, the Russians have shown continuously throughout this war and during the decade that preceded it, that they are prepared to negotiate. And they do make demands. And yes, they are difficult demands for the Ukrainians. But up to now, they have not been so severe that they in themselves would place in jeopardy the continued existence of Ukraine as a state and as a nation. So the Ukrainians do have a way out. They can negotiate. They can, I think, perhaps they should negotiate directly with the Russians. This is my own personal view. But, you know, if not, they can use the Americans as intermediaries. They can do whatever they wish. But they do need to start accepting that this policy of refusing any concessions at all, saying all the time that we're in the right and the Russians are in the wrong and that we are the victims of aggression and we shouldn't be made to pay the price, that is politically unsustainable. And they should work to achieve terms whilst they are still able. Because if there's a Russian breakthrough this summer, well, of course, the calculus in Moscow changes again.
Yes, it does. Well, for the sake of the people that are suffering from this war, I certainly hope that that diplomatic way is found out so we don't have to have a military conclusion here, because that would be a lot uglier in every way for the Ukrainian side. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alexander, and giving us some clarity on really all of these things here. And we certainly recommend your YouTube page to people who just can't get enough of you. And that's most of our audience here. Just go to Alexander Mercurius on YouTube. Just Google that and you will find these great shows like we're showing on the screen right now. So appreciate you and what you do. And we'll look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you very much, Daniel. And let's have you on our program too.
I'd love to be there. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. And we appreciate you guys too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. And also, we're going to take a look with a former Commodore, Steve Jeremy, on this afternoon, from the former combat vet, of a naval combat vet, is going to talk to us about, you know, what are some of the military either capabilities or limitations in using naval power to open up the Strait of Hormuz. People talk about that a lot. We're going to get it straight from a combat vet's mouth, what the realities are. Tune in today at 1 o'clock on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.